Are you concerned about microplastics in your home? Blue Land makes it easy to make sustainable choices. Blue Land cleaning sprays, toilet bowl cleaner, and dishwasher and laundry detergent tablets are free from dyes, parabens, and harsh chemicals. Blue Land is a certified B Corp and Leaping Bunny cruelty-free certified. Their formulas are EPA Safer Choice certified, and many products have also earned Cradle to Cradle's Gold Material Health Certificate. Get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/crooked. blueland.com/crooked.
Hi, this is Pod Save the UK. I'm Nish Kumar.
And I'm Coco Khan.
It was the battle of the two political big beasts this week. In the red corner, Sir Keir Starmer, Prime Minister and fan of following the correct process. In the blue corner, Sir Ollie Robbins, the recently sacked permanent undersecretary to the Foreign Office.
Both had to face questions over the Mandelson vetting process, confirming what they knew and when they knew it. Zoe Grudewald is here to give us the scoop on the row that could bring down a PM.
And the comedian Rosie Jones is coming to disrupt proceedings and to drain any sense of authority I still have as the host of this podcast. Can't wait. So, we've now heard in long, sometimes torturous detail from Keir Starmer and Ollie Robbins about their parts in the vetting process for Peter Mandelson's appointment as a very short-term UK ambassador to the US.
So a lot hinges on due process, so established precedent and the inner workings of Whitehall. So we're asking our political big-brained friend, Zoe Grunewald, the journalist and podcaster, to join us to discuss it all. Let's work through this in order. So first up, we have Keir Starmer. Now, we're all used to hearing rubbish puns and terrible jokes from the Commons, but this statement from Starmer got a proper laugh.
Mr. Speaker, I know many members across the House will find these facts to be incredible. To that, I can only say they are right. It beggars belief that throughout the whole...
I tell you what, it is quite extraordinary the look that he gives the House at that point, which is a kind of school teacher saying, listen, it's not funny when I say the penis enters the vagina. Okay, but the problem is, as with the penis entering the vagina, the facts being incredible is very funny. It's very funny. So obviously it's not the response that he's going to be hoping for. There's a lot of detail that's come at us this week, Zoe. Can you just do your absolute best to summarise where we've got to as we record at nearly 10 a.m. on Wednesday, the 22nd of April?
Sure. So I think the key thing is here is there is a lot of detail, right? And I think that's kind of what is bogging down some of the reporting on this and maybe meaning this isn't going to land as terminally for Keir Starmer in this moment, yeah, as some may have predicted. So Tuesday, Ollie Robbins gave evidence to the Select Committee about his role in the vetting process for Peter Mandelson, who of course was appointed US ambassador. Starmer on Monday gave a long update on the process as an investigations from the time of Mandelson's appointment onwards. He admitted he was wrong for the decision to appoint Mandelson and took responsibility for it. On the 14th of April, so last week, he discovered for the first time that Mandelson's clearance wasn't recommended after the developed vetting process. Foreign Office officials gave him developed vetting clearance despite this. Now, the key thing is that Ollie Robbins maintains that this appointment was essentially already a done deal. You know, Number 10 wanted it. The Cabinet Office were putting pressure on the Foreign Office to do it. They didn't seem to really care about developed vetting. In fact, he said, actually, they even suggested maybe we don't even need to vet Peter, yeah, Mandelson for this role because it's kind of sewn up and done. Keir Starmer is now maintaining if he had known that he had failed his security vetting, he wouldn't have appointed him. Well, that raises the question, why didn't you wait for the vetting to be complete before you announced the appointment?
Yes.
So that's where we are at the minute. We have these two conflicting versions of events. I think the key thing is Ollie Robbins didn't deny that he hadn't told the Prime Minister. His argument was it wasn't his place to do so, and it was already sewn up and done. Keir Starmer is essentially trying to move this from a question of his own judgment to a question of process. He's now changed the rules, so appointments can't be made unless vetting has passed,
yeah,
hoping this will quell the story. But ultimately, this all comes back with all the process and who knew what and whether forms were filled in and whether you should have a position if you've passed your vetting or not. I think the key question for most people, for MPs and for voters, is why was Peter Mandelson appointed in the first place when a lot of these concerns about his character, his behaviour, his career history were already actually well known?
Can I just say briefly here, it has really restored my faith in our security services. Because I have to say, when Peter Mandelson was appointed, I thought, what's going on, lads? How has this fella slipped through the net? So it has slightly reassured me that the security services did have very serious concerns. Because again, one of the things that I've sort of found, like, and thank you for that brilliant summation of everything that's gone on this week. There's more to come, which we'll get into. But also, it is quite weird that we've had to sit here and we've had, you know, listen to, you know, serious commentators and journalists and media professionals talk about what Starmer knew and what he didn't know. We all knew that the Channel 4 Dispatches documentary aired in 2019. Now, I assume Keir Starmer has access to a television. And in the Dispatches documentary, I'm happy to be corrected if I'm wrong here, but that documentary raised concerns that Peter Mandelson had continued a friendship with Jeffrey Epstein after he had been convicted, of these very, very grave and serious crimes. So we were all just sort of having to pretend that Keir Starmer didn't know about any of this. I feel a bit gaslit by what's happened and the way that it's been talked about. I find it very, very strange that we've all had to go through this kind of elaborate process of saying, well, it all depends on what Keir Starmer knew.
No.
We all fucking knew.
Yeah.
There were people making jokes when the appointment happened. I think possibly me. There were lots of people making jokes that were variations of course Mandelson knows Trump. They were on the planes together.
Keir Starmer said last week he was stunned by the revelations, right? Wouldn't it have been stunning if Peter Mandelson had passed vetting?
Yeah.
Just simply with a quick Google search, as you're right, that would have been actually the shocking newspaper headline, that man who is friends with has been friends with a convicted paedophile, who has been out of government twice, who works for a company that has links to China and Russia. He's great to receive the most classified briefings from the top of government. He's a thoroughly trustworthy man. I mean, no.
The picture that's being painted at the moment is about this very high-pressure situation where, everyone's denying who is applying the pressure, but that there is pressure to get Mandelson into this post. Why? Why is there so much pressure? Why does waiting 2 months, why would that really matter?
Mm. I think this is the key question that we need to keep asking. And I think you're totally right, Nish. Like, Keir Starmer is trying to flood this with detail to move the story on and make it about civil service processes and throwing civil servants under the bus while he does it, which is never a good look for a Labour Prime Minister. But ultimately, the key question is, why did it have to be Mandelson so much? Like, why did it have to be Mandelson? There was a perfectly good woman in post in the US. They got rid of her and they wanted Mandelson in there. Why? Well, we know that Mandelson was close with Morgan McSweeney. So, you know, there was a sense there that maybe they were doing each other a favour. There was also this sense that with a Trump administration, you kind of need to send someone in who can speak the language of the people around Donald Trump. And this is something that the government can't really say, because it kind of admits quite publicly that we were willing to sort of debase ourselves because that's how we perceive the US administration, that you need to send someone who's quite unsavoury and to deal with them. So that's kind of the elephant in the room here, that actually they thought Peter Mandelson would be good for the job. But there was a perfectly good person in post who was well known to the US, who was well liked. It was actually quite a strange decision to expedite the appointment of Peter Mandelson, who was so divisive on the Labour backbenches, who, you're right, had allegations about him being friends with Epstein. I mean, it wasn't just the Channel 4 dispatch document. The FT were on this for a long time.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, sorry,
You know, there was that famous interview on the train where they asked him about his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein and he told them to fuck off.
Yeah.
That was all public knowledge. The question still remains, what was going on behind the scenes that meant this was so important? And I think it's a combination of that kind of masculine, real politic that defined the team around Keir Starmer, which I'm sure we'll get onto, but also the fact that there was a group of people around Keir Starmer who were doing a bit of back scratching and trying to serve some jobs for their mates. And that's not uncommon in politics. That's cronyism. But that's the exact thing that Keir Starmer railed against when he was going against Boris Johnson.
Possibly the moment of the day, certainly the clip that's been doing the rounds on various news reports about this happened when the chair of the committee, Emily Thornberry, really made sure that we heard every word from the former chief of staff and close ally of Peter Mandelson, Morgan McSweeney, in terms of his role in maybe expediting this process. It is the thing that sums up the pressure that McSweeney was putting to expedite Mandelson's appointment.
And said, in terms stronger than those that I can use before the watershed.
I think you should.
Well, I'll just say that it was just to prove it with terms stronger than that. Does that accord with your impression?
Just fucking approve it.
Thornbury. Just making sure that that got in there. Zoe, how normal is this kind of political pressure over this kind of an appointment?
So, political pressure over senior appointments is normal in many ways. You know, number 10 almost always has a preferred candidate, especially for a role that's as politically sensitive and high profile as US ambassador,
sure,
right? Prime ministers are also entitled to want people they trust and are politically aligned in key diplomatic posts. But there are clear informal guardrails. And I think this is where this edges into the grayer, more uncomfortable territory. So the civil service runs vetting and preparatory checks independently. Ministers can express preference, but they're not supposed to override those preferences or preempt the process because then it just makes it, you know, null and void. And of course, there is a strong convention that due diligence is real, you know, that the government should be doing its due diligence. It's not just a performative thing you do to tick boxes, but already you've got it sewn up. I think what was key about Ollie Robbins' testimony yesterday is he kept talking about this constant pressure, this dismissive attitude to vetting. Essentially, that the outcome was put first and the checks came later. And I think what was also particularly striking was that he said Mandelson already, essentially, had already moved into the role. You know, he was already accessing classified material before the vetting concluded. He already had access to the computer systems. You know, he'd already been announced. They'd already set up the process to get him accepted in the US. It wasn't just the routine procedure of, this is our preferred candidate, please can you progress it? It was, this needs to happen quickly. It's already been announced. Find a way to make it work. And I think that's where, as a civil servant, you start to feel compromised and the line starts to feel blurred.
Well, he certainly didn't pull his punches. We've actually got a clip of Robbins here.
I'm afraid what that translated into for my team in the Foreign Office and certainly the handover briefing I was getting as I arrived at post was what I felt was a generally dismissive attitude to his vetting clearance. The focus was on getting Mandelson out to Washington quickly.
Well, I mean, he's said it as clear as he can. I my mind does keep returning to your point, Zoe, about the flooding the zone with the details. I mean, I am throughout all of this, I keep coming back to the outrageous immorality at the heart of it. And I think sometimes, you know, we're guilty of it as well. You can lose that. And I think the press have been particularly bad at it. We're talking a lot about like due process rather than the fact that everybody knew that Mandelson was friends with a convicted pedo. Everybody knew that and he was still allowed the post. Do you think that any of this process is going to change that?
There are still questions about Keir Starmer's judgment here. And I think the other thing that came out yesterday, which is going to further those questions about Keir Starmer's judgment and the ethics of the decisions he makes, of course, is the fact that Ollie Robbins suggested that Matthew Doyle, his previous director of communications, was also trying to be set up for an ambassadorial role, again, despite being friends with a convicted sex offender.
This is fairly extraordinary. So Starmer was essentially getting rid of Matthew Doyle because he wasn't very good at his job. That seems to be the sense that I've been getting from reading some of the reporting. He's basically suggested that there was pressure put on them to find an ambassadorial job for him while they were in the process of getting rid of him. And also, Robbins has claimed that he was told to not inform the then Foreign Secretary, David Lammy. Now, the job never actually materialised and Doyle went on to become a Labour peer. But as you say, it emerged that he had campaigned for a friend who'd been charged with possessing indecent images of children. There's two things that I think mean this is a problem for Keir Starmer. One, it looks like being friends with a paedophile is a qualifying factor for getting a job with Keir Starmer. The appearance of this is not good. To appoint one friend of a paedophile may be considered folly. To appoint two is like a real issue here. Suddenly, this looks like a pattern of behaviour. You know, it looks like jobs for the boys and the boys themselves are friends with some very, very unpleasant people. But isn't the real problem, even beyond that awful situation, that Keir Starmer's offering to the country is not one of an ambitious policy programme that reforms the machinery of the British state and delivers decisive change to the country. His offering is that he will manage the institutions of this country more effectively. I think Tom McTague from The New Statesman, after he wrote the profile of Keir Starmer, he came on this show and he said that his belief is that Starmer thinks that there is nothing wrong with the institutions of this country. They've just been managed poorly. And Starmer made a huge amount of political hay from criticising Boris Johnson over Partygate and criticising the way that the previous Conservative government interacted with the civil service. Now, if you have no offering to the country other than effective management of institutions and a sense of moral probity combined with a sort of granular focus on procedure, and then it turns out that you're not really managing your institutions properly because you're spending all of your time trying to get jobs for your friends, and that your moral probity is in question because those friends have friends that are some of the most unpleasant people in the history of our species. And then the third thing is that you are not observing granular detail because you're trying to expedite the hiring of those friends of unpleasant people. That means that Keir Starmer is toast here because he is failing in his principal offering to the country, not just in the election campaign, but since the election. That's why I think he's done. And I think what you said about the idea that there isn't an obvious person in waiting, I think, is the only thing keeping him in the job right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, how bad do you think the brand of the Labour Party is right now with all of this? I mean, I find this whole story absolutely mortifying, genuinely. I mean, I you know, you use the word real politic and, you know, I do appreciate that politics can be a grubby business, but you kind of must stop. You have to have a line, right? You have to have a line. And I think Labour has always had a brand that was that they had certainly a slightly better baseline than the Conservatives. And I suppose they're all just very lucky that this is everything that happened with Jeffrey Epstein went across party lines. And I suppose that's lucky because it's the sort of thing that another side would go for. I mean, I could imagine certainly sections of the right, if it wasn't Donald Trump involved with it, would be going for this really, really hard. And certainly as someone like myself who spends time on the kind of angry parts of the internet, you hear this emerging, the Epstein class, you hear this phrase. Yeah. And lots of people are just, they really do just see Labour as bad as everyone else.
Yeah.
That's been creeping for a while. Do you think the brand of the Labour Party is done?
I think it's really been damaged. I think, Nish, you're totally right. Your analysis of Keir Starmer and how he's basically failed on every metric you could use to deem his success. You know, his
the metrics that he set out for himself,
his attention to detail, his morality. You know, his wanting to kind of restore the institutions. I mean, when it's jobs for the boys, and you know, it doesn't matter if they're friends of the pedo. And oh, I wasn't across that document, so I don't know. Well, you've failed, quite frankly. And I think you're right, Coco. Like all of those things are now feeding through. Because voters can tolerate mistakes, right? This is the thing. Voters understand that politicians are going to make mistakes. What they don't tolerate is hypocrisy and cronyism. And that's what this story reeks of. Keir Starmer was stood there on the opposite side of the dispatch box with Boris Johnson during Partygate, skewering him over both those things. Now, he has lent into both of those things and just said, oh, well, you know, I didn't really know what I was doing. And I think particularly, and I really want to pick up on this boys club thing, because I feel personally aggrieved by this, as I'm sure other journalists in Westminster do, because I remember before Keir Starmer was Prime Minister, when he was Leader of the Opposition, there was lots of disquiet on the Labour backbenches and amongst pads and amongst staffers about this boys club around Keir Starmer, about this group of men who made decisions unilaterally, who didn't engage with backbenchers, who had that real politic approach of, you guys don't really understand what real politics is like, you know, leave it to the guys. You know, just this sense of, actually, it was a very sewn up, close-knit group around Keir Starmer who made decisions and they just didn't really care about the lived experience of marginal people, or, you know, or the years of experience on their back benches. And I remember saying to quite a senior broadcaster, I think one of the issues for Keir Starmer is this perception of a boys' club. And he shut me down. He was like, I don't think so. I've not heard that. That's not a thing. Now,
very big boys' club energy, isn't it?
I obviously felt really stupid because I was a junior reporter. I was like, oh, maybe I'm misunderstood, or maybe that's just how politics works. You know, that's kind of my bad. Now, it is seen as almost the original sin of this government, right? If you think about all their failures on winter fuel, disability cuts, two-child benefit cap, all of those come back to this being a kind of heartless government that didn't engage with its backbenchers over what they were seeing amongst their constituents and what they themselves have experienced. And also this lack of loyalty on the backbenchers was because they never engaged with them. They didn't respect backbenchers' perspectives on things. You know, they weren't interested. When it comes to Matthew Doyle and Peter Mandelson, I'm not saying that women are totally infallible. You know, famously, one of our worst prime ministers, Liz Truss, was a woman, okay? I'm not saying that...
She did it for the girlies.
If there were more women
we
in the room...
We can fail too.
I'm not saying if there were more women in the room, every decision would have been correct. But I can't help but feel if there was more lived experience, more marginalised perspectives in the room, someone would have said, why are we appointing a man who's friends with a paedophile? What does that say about us as a government? And I think ultimately, you can almost track all of Keir Starmer's failings to this big bully boys club.
I do think it's an astonishingly bold move for a man to say, there's no boys club, shut up. Like that is an even for the British media is like, that's bad even for us. The image that you've been trying to portray is of a kind of cabal of people not interested in, not even just the wider interests of the country, but in their party. Mm. When you consider that there is this group of people that isn't taking into account what their ministers are saying, that explains how it's possible for them to be surprised by the scale of the rebellion on something like the Winterfell, because they aren't meeting with the backbenchers. Mm. They aren't talking to their own people.
There are lots of critics of Morgan McSweeney who say that was his approach. You know, he was very much of the kind of Blue Labour ilk. He was kind of a lot more sort of socially conservative and, you know, actually didn't like the progressive wing of the Labour Party very much at all and kind of set out to destroy it. I was just thinking when you were talking there, Nish, Emily Thornberry making sure that comment was heard in full. I'm sure that was a reference to this because there has been so much frustration amongst MPs about the way that that number 10 operation was conducting itself, the lack of respect it had for backbenchers or civil servants, or whatever. I mean, you can see that. And when you think about who has departed this Labour government, now, of course, Ollie Robbins has gone. But before that, it was Lou Hague, Angela Rayner, Sue Gray. I mean, there was a raft of senior women that were pushed out and very few men. And so when Morgan McSweeney's head was finally on the chopping board, a lot of people felt able to say, it's because it's a boys' club. And it's not just a gendered thing. You know, if you speak to people in BAME Labour as well, BAME Labour, they will say they also feel sidelined. You know, disabled people, campaigners who are on the fringes of the Labour group, they'll say we were sidelined when they were trying to reform the disability system. Yeah. So I would say this, these questions over Mandelson and, Matthew Doyle, they all feed into this sense, you know, of it's a certain male, white male, masculine Labour Party at the minute.
Ed Miliband certainly wasn't pulling his punches, shall we say. So here's what he said to Sophie Ridge on Sky when he was sort of pressed on this.
Prime ministers make errors. Prime ministers are fallible. Prime ministers are human. As you know, I steered well clear of Peter Mandelson when I became Labour leader in 2010. But people make mistakes.
That's a drive-by.
Mm.
That's a drive-by from Red Ed.
I see how it happens. Obviously, it wouldn't happen to me. It doesn't have any sense, but I can see how it happened.
But just looking forward, Zoe, so you believe, just for want of an alternative, that Starmer is still going to be in post at the time of the May elections, which is obviously what we want to talk about next with you. But with the remaining Mandelson files, so we haven't seen all of the information yet. Do you have a sense of when they're coming and if there are more damaging revelations?
So the next tranche of files will be released after the King's speech, which is May the 13th. I'm not sure we've got an exact date, but that's when we're expecting the next round of documents. Obviously, that's after local elections. It will be interesting to see after locals, if we start to get a sense that Keir Starmer is getting ready to step down, that there are other contenders waiting in the wings. In terms of what's more to come, I mean, remember, we still have a police investigation as well, ongoing into some of the contents of the Epstein files, and that includes, obviously, Prince Andrew as well. There is obviously...
Just Andrew.
Oh, Andrew.
Randy Andy.
Formerly known as Prince. It's hard to say. It's hard to say what will be in them and what won't be. I think at this point, I mean, there is, again, it goes back to that thing you were saying, okay, there's so much terrible stuff already out there. What more do we need? Yeah. Like, you know, what can they tell us that Peter Mandelson did that could be the smoking gun thus far?
We'll just go back to my bingo card of doom. Just see what we'll pull out. Peter Mandelson also spread COVID.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just put it in there.
Yeah. And people would just go, oh, you know, and Kirsten would go, well, if I knew that, I still would have appointed him US ambassador.
I can't believe I didn't know he kept bats. Everyone knew he got bats from China.
I am shocked at the fact that Peter Mandelson takes his holidays at the Wuhan wet market. Yeah. This information is shocking to me.
I think the key thing, though, is that it's going to keep being in the news. So Keir Starmer can't just, like, brush this away as a failure of judgment. It's going to keep coming up and people keep going to, you know, grab their heads and say, why, Starmer? Why did you do it? You're right. He's toast. It's just a question of when the party is ready to get rid of him. I would say there's no way he's going to lead us into the next general election. He'll probably be gone by the end of the year. Although, again, when something like Iran happens, people tend to, what was that phrase Boris Johnson used? Make a protective ring around the Pritzker.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, because it feels so big and existential, and having a leadership election in that can feel quite self-indulgent. So time will tell. But I don't think, to be honest, Keir Starmer would like to lead this party into the next general election.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's look at the next big marker for Starmer's leadership. Labour was already expecting a wipeout in the May elections. So I guess let's talk about how bad it can get for them and who maybe the likely beneficiaries of that wipeout will be.
PodSave the UK is brought to you by Incogni.
Your most private information isn't just out there. It's being bought and sold by data brokers who profit from your personal details. Incogni helps you fight back by finding and deleting your data from hundreds of shady directories. Instead of spending hundreds of hours doing the work yourself, Incogni automates the entire process and keeps a watchful eye to ensure your data doesn't reappear.
If privacy is something that concerns you, and who can blame you, it's such a valuable tool. I'm sure I'm not the only one who has found themselves scrabbling over passwords set up years and years ago. How would I ever be able to get those back? And so an automated service, which is scrubbing your data for you, is just such a relief.
Getting started is simple. Create an account, provide the minimum details needed to find your profiles, and authorize Incogni to act on your behalf. Once you've given the green light, they handle the heavy lifting of contacting hundreds of data brokers.
For the ultimate cleanup, their unlimited plan includes a custom removal feature. Just send a link to a privacy expert, they'll scrub the rest.
Take your personal data back with Incogni. Go to incogni.com/podsavetheuk and use code podsavetheuk to get 60% off an annual plan.
That's code PODSAVETHEUK at incogni.com/PODSAVETHEUK for 60% off.
Try it risk-free for 30 days with their money-back guarantee.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe.
When it comes to sending money abroad, many providers claim to offer free fees and competitive rates, but don't be fooled. This can be code for inflated exchange rates.
With the Wise account, you can send, spend and receive money in over 40 currencies without ever having to worry about hidden fees.
Sending pounds across the pond, most transfers arrive in 20 seconds or less.
Spending Riyaz in Rio, the Wise travel card gives you the mid-market rate on every purchase with no costly markups on your bill.
Getting paid in dollars for your side gig. I'm looking at you, Nish. Avoid hidden fees and get the real exchange rate every time.
With 24/7 access to live support, your international transactions with Wise are quick, transparent and safe. Plus, Wise runs over 7 million daily checks to catch and prevent fraud. 15 million people already trust Wise to manage their money internationally. Be smart, get Wise.
Now, in just 2 weeks, voters will go to the polls across the country in what is shaping up to be a huge reckoning, not just for Labour, but for the two-party system itself. In Scotland and Wales, there's elections for all the seats in the devolved parliament, while across England, around 5,000 council seats are up for grabs, plus there's 6 mayoral elections.
Zoe, for a while now, everybody's been predicting a massive Labour defeat. Ben Walker, who's the polling expert and co-founder of Britain Elects, has said that May will be a total bloodbath for Labour.
how bad is this really going to be? How much blood is in the bath?
Yeah, it's funny because having just moaned about Westminster, this is actually one of the reasons I love it as well, because local elections and bloodbath in the same sentence is like so hyperbolic. But, you know, if you really care about local elections, sure, it's going to be a bloodbath. So obviously there's going to be a lot of expectation management going on with Labour at the minute, because they are going to have a lot of losses. It's not, you know, they're not hoping for gains. I think if you're looking at where Labour is likely to suffer the most, it's going to be councils where they won or overperformed when there was that kind of peak anti-Tory sentiment a few years ago, and areas where Reform are eating into their vote and where Greens and Independents are eating into their vote. I think the big structural problem for Labour is, of course, it's the party of government, so it's going to absorb all the frustration, and that is very typical for locals. Yeah. You know, it's midterm. There's not a lot of change. There's a lot of difficulties that people are experiencing in their life. Councils are facing cutbacks as cost of living. So it's quite natural that they would face losses. But then equally, they haven't built a deep, loyal electoral coalition. Part of that is because they're only 2 years in. Part of that is because they seem intent on destroying their deep, loyal electoral coalition. So voters are going to drift and protest. So it's going to be difficult for them. They're still going to perform relatively strongly in Scotland and Wales, probably compared to England, but it's not going to be anything in terms of kind of clear momentum.
Well, the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has certainly taken a different approach to campaigning. At a live podcast recording on Tuesday, she told hecklers to fuck right off when they accuse her of copying Reform policies.
I've read the remarks. Whenever she's pushed on these immigration policies, she, you know, she said she accused them of being white liberals. Mm. And she also, obviously we talked about this on the show at the time, she said that, you know, she's the one that's being called a fucking packy in the street over immigration. She is weaponizing her identity as rhetorical cover for the implementation of draconian immigration policies. And I'm struggling to differentiate her from Rishi Sunak and Suella Braverman in terms of the use of a marginalised identity as ideological cover for draconian hardline immigration policies. I have such a deep well of upset and frustration. I think it's disgusting. I think it's absolutely disgusting.
Nish is going to melt, so we will move on. But I did see Michael Gove talking about Shabana Mood with saying that she was his political crush. I think he also meant literal crush. But anyway, we'll move on from that. And that really does tell you something, you know, that if you have figures like Michael Gove saying that he's seen her political journey and where she started, i.e. probably a bit more progressive, and where she's ended up, and loves that. Oh, makes my skin crawl.
If I can just jump in, obviously, Nish, I don't want to cause you to have an aneurysm, but I agree with both of you. I also think there's something weird going on here, right? So a politician telling a group of voters to fuck off, especially a minister, a Secretary of State, that's unusual. We shouldn't lose sight of the fact that that is not really very normal. Also, a former minister saying publicly that they have a crush on another. Again, a bit gross, unusual. There's this kind of deliberate coarsening of political language and debate going on. To me, I think it's spilling over from the fact that so many politicians live on X now, where there's just like no guardrails, no rules. But I think we have to be aware of it. And I'm not saying we should, you know, I understand people feel angry towards politicians and it changes the way we speak, but I just feel it's a deliberate attempt to bring politics into quite an unpleasant space where you can be full of like hate and disrespectful to minorities and women. Like, I don't think Michael Gove should be sexualizing Shabana Mahmood in that way. I just think it's something we're seeing, and we're seeing more and more of it. And, you know, people love Donald Trump. You know, his voters love Donald Trump because he says it how it is, and he, you know, he swears at the Iranian regime. Do we want to import that level of political rhetoric? I don't know. Maybe I'm being too kind of woke and galaxy-brained about it. No, I just find it a bit gross.
Well, as they say on X, the bar is on the floor.
Yeah.
So look, with Labour forecast to do so poorly and Reform riding high in the polls, everyone had assumed that Nigel Farage's party would do well in May. Reform said they're hoping to hoover up as many as 1,500 council seats, but it might not be such smooth sailing.
A more in common national poll released last week puts Reform on just 25%. So that's still in the top spot, but it's down 5 points. And most polls have shown some kind of downward trend in the last few months. Zoe, is it possible that reform have peaked a little too early in this conversation? And also, is it for people listening? So we did a sort of excited dance at the prospect.
A little jiggle.
Just a little,
little shimmer.
Is it the fact that Rupert Lowe's Restore Britain party is siphoning support away from reform? Restore has been polling around 4% nationally, and we have to assume that that's eaten away a bit of Farage's support. Is this an either-or situation where it's also connected to Farage's support for Donald Trump and the war in Iran? So the day after the war began, Farage said Britain must back the Americans in this vital fight against Iran and urged Starmer to allow British military bases to be used. He's then backtracked, saying he's worried about Trump's war aims. But the backtrack may be too late, and the backtrack potentially is not tracked back far enough because UK voters largely at the moment are still against the war. Is it Rupert Lowe? Is it Donald Trump? Is it a combination of the two, or is it something else?
It's a combination of the two, and a secret third thing, which is that you can't be a protest party vehicle forever. The closer and closer you get to government, the more that voters have to take you seriously, and they actually wonder if, you know, you can achieve all the things that you say you are. And I think there have been some policies recently, particularly on their kind of really hardline immigration, deportation stuff, also things that seem slightly incoherent and you can't pay for, like some of that economic policy around, you know, the triple lock and things like that. It just has given more scrutiny on the party. And I think it's kind of, for some voters, that will sort of turn away, for example, former Tory voters who don't want that, or former Labour voters who don't want that. So there's a bit of that as well. Definitely the internal fragmentation, that was always going to be a problem for them, because Nigel Farage doesn't want to be tied to people like Tommy Robinson or Rupert Lowe, but there will be other people who will drift that way. And if there's an option for voters who like that, they'll choose that option. Definitely, Iran has been difficult for both Farage and Badenoch because they made completely the wrong call. And also, obviously, Trump is looking increasingly deranged, and that's no good for Farage, who cozies up to him. So there's all those things. And the fact that a lot of people don't like Nigel Farage, you know. But in some ways, he's the party's best asset. In other ways, he's going to put so many people off. A lot of people don't like him. They see straight through him. He's actually not as popular as the media likes to make out that he is. You know, you look at Gorton and Denton, and you look at Keir Philly. Reform didn't win either of those. And both of those were target seats for them. They should have been opportunities for them to prove themselves. They actually struggled. And some of it was their strategy. I mean, why they put Matt Goodwin out there. That was a terrible decision.
The most unlikable man out there. Again, they live on X.
Well, exactly. So, you know, and there's some things they can maybe learn from that. And then if I can add in another thing, it's that actually, and I guess it goes back to Trump, I'm tentatively hopeful that the populist right is slightly on the retreat across the world. I mean, if you look at what's happening in Europe, if you look at France, where the National Rally isn't performing as strongly as it was doing, or if you look at
Hungary,
where Orban obviously just lost, and other countries, you know, in Italy, Meloni, she's still polling well, but she's struggling actually to implement a lot of her agenda. Yeah. Trump is also just this kind of, you know, poison that's spreading, and you know, it doesn't look good, and it definitely reveals some of the hypocrisies and inconsistencies of having a nationalist agenda, because all it takes is one madman across the world and you're all sucked into his orbit.
Yeah.
So I think there's lots of things going on here. I am hopeful, and I always like to give a bit of hope to this podcast, that 25-30% that really could be Reform's ceiling. The difficulty is, if they can split enough of the vote, and if Labour are facing a split on the left, could you see a pathway where there is more Reform dominance or a Reform victory?
So let's talk about Wales and Scotland, because that is potentially a danger for in both of those countries. So in Wales, Labour could see its most devastating result. Labour's won the most seats in the Senedd since its inception in 1999. But now the More in Common polling is putting them third. So Plaid Cymru would be taking the top spot with Reform in second. This is a huge, huge, huge problem for Labour. Right,
absolutely. Zoe? Yeah. So this is probably where the most kind of structurally significant shift is happening. There's been long-term economic underperformance in Wales. So lower wages, higher poverty, the cost of living crisis is hitting really hard. And then those kind of UK-wide decisions like the tax threshold freezes are feeding into this kind of devolved dissatisfaction. Labour's dominance hasn't just disappeared overnight, but it's becoming a lot more conditional, and voters are looking elsewhere. So, you know, Plaid Cymru are really benefiting from this. So they're mixing a lot of economic critique, so concerns over the cost of living crisis, with national identity and sort of saying, you know, decisions made in Westminster aren't in your best interests. This is where I think both with the Greens and Gortner Denton and Plaid Cymru, we're seeing actually that the left or the centre-left are starting to wake up a bit and tweak and refine their messaging to appeal to those disaffected voters. So reform could well do well in Wales. You know, they can tap into this economic frustration, particularly in those kind of post-industrial areas. But again, this isn't just one shift, it's fragmentation. Labour's losing to different parties across Wales because they are isolating their voter base and they're not actually dealing with people's material concerns.
Let's go to Scotland. So all 129 members of the Scottish Parliament are also up for re-election. Scotland's First Minister and leader of the SNP, John Swinney, has tried to centre their campaign around the cost of living crisis. Last week, he announced their pledge to cap the price of certain essential supermarket groceries. So that would limit the cost of things like bread, milk and cheese. What do you think about these policies at the moment? They got a touch of the Zoran Mamdani about them. Do you think that they'll cut through? Do you think they could be popular?
I think what the left or the centre-left are realising is that, you know, people are angry because they feel materially worse off. So having a strong economic offering, which was typically what the left was known for, is kind of the way forward. So you're right, touch of the Mamdani about it.
Can't believe I'm telling you this, but I'm up for this policy because I recently have been radicalised by Crosta and Mollica. So I was do you know that upmarket chilled pizza brand?
Crosta and Mollica, I do, yes.
Yeah, anyway.
I've never heard one, but yeah.
It's
you'd recognise the branding.
You'd recognise it. It's a fancy chilled pizza. Anyway, so I was in the chilled pizza aisle and I saw it. I thought, oh, that looks nice. Oh, how much? I had this moment where I looked around at all the various chilled pizzas and thought, God, those have... You know, just occasionally have a little moment where you're like, wow, I know that food inflation is going up, but just occasionally it really hits you.
Are they frozen pizzas?
No, they're chilled pizzas.
Chilled pizzas?
Chilled. They're in the fridge section.
They're just relaxed.
they're in the fridge section. Anyway, I don't know why, but I just went into this deep dive about why chilled pizzas are so expensive, particularly compared to frozen pizzas. And, you know, there was all this different stuff about the rising cost of ingredients and also the process of chilling them and transportation. But also, fundamentally, a lot of the chilled pizza pricing is not about the cost of the product, but about where it sits in the market. So lots of people can't afford to go out and eat a pizza. And so this is where those brands come in.
Right,
you can have a fancy pizza at home. So it's nothing, well, I mean, obviously it is something to do with the cost of ingredients and all these other things, which supermarket bosses also like to talk about and food leaders also like to talk about. But let's be honest, a lot of it is just marketing. So I mean, I'm up for it. I've been radicalised by Crosta and Mollica.
This has opened a whole new world up to me. I only believed pizzas came in hot or frozen, and this sort of third way Clinton and Blair era social democrat chilled pizza is really blowing my mind.
Zoe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
PodSave the UK is brought to you by Aura Frames.
Aura Frames is the answer to every gifting moment.
Listen, when you're trying to buy a gift for a loved one, there's a lot of options. And you're panicking, but you could just do what Coco and I have both done, which is get an Aura frame. It is a fantastic gift. You can upload photos onto it. It has free unlimited storage. You can even preload the photos before it ships. If, like me, the person you're giving that gift to is your parents and they don't know how to use even basic technology and occasionally phone you saying, how do you find Google? These frames can be preloaded with photos. You can personalize your gift. There's a gift box included. So every frame comes packaged in a premium gift box. And you can share your photos with absolutely minimal effort when you download the Aura app, or you can text photos straight to your frame.
Yeah, I think the ease of the interface cannot be overstated enough. It's really simple for every relative that you might have. And of course, who could ever be unhappy with a box that they open and it's your face? What a wonderful gift. What a wonderful gift. Perfect gift every time, I would say. So for a limited time, save on this perfect gift by visiting auraframes.co.uk to get £25 off Aura's best-selling Carver matte frames. They've been named the top frame by The Independent, and you can use the promo code PSTUK at checkout. That's Aura Frames, A-U-R-A, frames.co.uk, promo code PSTUK. Support the show by mentioning us at the checkout. Terms and conditions apply.
PodSave the UK is brought to you by ShipStation.
When your company is growing fast, order fulfillment can make or break your success. ShipStation's intelligence-driven platform brings order management, rate shopping, inventory and returns, warehouse systems, and comprehensive analytics all in one place, saving customers 15 hours per week on fulfillment.
With ShipStation, everything you need to manage getting orders to customers is in one place. You can connect to over 200 sales channels, and instead of 5 to 7 different disconnected tools, you've got it all in one place.
ShipStation compares rates across all major UK carriers, so that includes Royal Mail, Evri, DPD, UPS, and many, many more, to find you the best shipping option on every order.
I have a lot of friends that run their own businesses. They have to spend a lot of time sending things out. ShipStation is a way of setting up time-saving automation, so you pick the best delivery service, finds you the best rate, prints labels in bulk, sends tracking updates, and you're done.
I did have a little resale fashion thing going on years ago, you know,
wow.
Selling the wavy garms on the internet to the ute. I believe that's how we describe it. So yeah, so like genuinely, like I understand that. I mean, obviously mine was just my personal little side project, but like I get it, like shipping takes forever.
Yeah.
And it really takes up a lot of headspace when that's not what you want to be doing. So absolutely delighted to be telling everyone about ShipStation.
Well, if you're running your own business or doing whatever seemingly semi-legal business Coco Karma's doing, you need ShipStation. Try ShipStation free for 60 days. Go to ShipStation.com and use code PSTUK for 60 days for free. 60 days gives you plenty of time to see exactly how much time and money you're saving on every shipment. That's ShipStation.com, PSTUK. ShipStation.com, code PSTUK.
Okay, brace yourselves, everybody. Rosie Jones is in the Pod Save the UK studio. Rosie Jones is a comedian, and it says here, living proof that chaos can, in fact, be organised into punchlines. She's been here for about 10 minutes and has mentioned her vagina 5 times.
No! About 8! At least.
They've written an intro for me to read, and they've insisted it's me that reads this. So I think this is...
I quite like this because you never lovely to me. Carry on.
Alongside her award-winning stand-up... What awards have you won?
All of them!
She's also been a regular on TV shows like The Last Leg and picked up a BAFTA nomination for her chaotic travel show Trip Hazard. That's not to mention co-writing a 6-part comedy drama Pushers for Channel 4, acting jobs from Casualty to Silent Witness to playing God in a play in Glasgow recently, and authoring several children's books. Basically, Rosie Jones is... terribly talented.
God damn good. I am so good.
For context for listeners and viewers, Rosie Jones and I are old friends, go back a long way.
No. You want to be my friends, and sometimes I give in.
Rosie was my opening act at various points in my 2018-19 tour, and so yes, we go back a long way, and she does not respect me.
Can I tell everyone how I would introduce you?
Please.
To your own show?
Yeah.
Every night.
Bear in mind, you pay a comedian to warm the audience up for you. That's the context. The job she's supposed to do is get the audience laughing and then welcome me to the stage with some fanfare.
So I would do 20 minutes of pure gold stand-up material. The audience will be electric. And then I will say, right, now is the time that I got to introduce Nishikuma. But before he comes out, I just need to say, don't get your hopes up. I mean, it's okay, but it's no Ramesh.
I paid her. I was paying her money. to do that job. And then I would come out and say, give it up for Rosie Jones. I only got her to support me so we could park closer to the venue.
Yes!
Very good.
I'm happy to see you. I love you.
I love you. I'm so happy to see you. You have gone great.
I'm aware of that, okay?
Very great.
You know, it's been a very stressful few years, hasn't it?
This is a UK news podcast. We're not here to talk about my grey hairs or your vagina, okay?
I think we are. Your hair grey, my vagina bald. To be fair, I'm glad that it's that way.
This is a UK news and politics podcast.
Like, look, I'm honestly trying to find a way into the news. I like, part of me was like, okay, Nish's grey hair is stressful. Let's talk about the news. Rosie, I'm going to ask you a serious question.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm trying.
It's not just comedy that keeps you busy.
No.
You've got a foundation as well.
I do.
Rosie Jones Foundation.
Yes.
How's it going? What's the mission? Tell us about it.
Really good. So we just turned 1 year. So we're babies. And our mission is simple. We want to create a world in which no person with cerebral palsy feels alone or unheard. And I started this journey a few years ago because I love comedy, I love making people laugh. But I've always been so aware that the world is burning and I wanted to do something. And I was so shocked to find that there was a severe lack of services and help out there for people, specifically adults with cerebral palsy. And I know this firsthand. When I was a child, I got physio, I got speech therapy, and at 18, I got bye-bye!
Really?
See you later. Good luck. And CP is one of the only lifelong conditions that you don't get help with from the NHS over 18. I'm 36. Now, so I haven't seen a medical professional specifically about my disability in nearly 2 decades. And then, aside from that, again, I know firsthand about what a physical disability takes in terms of your mental health to enter the world every day that doesn't make you feel welcome. And we, during that research, found that if you got a physical disability, you're much more likely to suffer with your mental health. So our first mission setting up the foundation was we found an incredible should be to provide for disabilities plus, which matches people with disabilities to see a counsellor with the same disability as them, and go to see a counsellor with the same disability as me is a game changer. In 6 months alone, we've funded over 800 sessions for people with CP. So, yeah, we are small, but we are making a real tangible difference already.
I imagine it's more necessary now, right? So, you know, we've seen Labour try to push through a series of cuts to disability. From this month, almost 750,000 ill and disabled claimants are at risk of having the health element of their benefit halved to £50 a week. I mean, what are your concerns for the people that you're currently helping, and how will this make it harder to help others?
Oh, there's so much concern. I think me with a lot of us, as soon as Labour came in, we were like, yay! Good times ahead. And there's just time and time again broke my heart to see this party who I actually refuse to call Labour because it's not any kind of Labour Party that I recognise, and I hear from disabled people every day who are struggling because of the benefit cuts, and it will only get worse. Millions of disabled people out there are not capable of taking on more work to bridge that gap, which means that more of our community will fall into poverty.
It should be devastating for any Labour MP in the government to hear that, because, you know, the background to this is 14 years of austerity. A lot of the cuts disproportionately affected disabled communities. Yeah. So we're starting from a position of these are communities that have been under a kind of economic siege for the, you know, best part of a decade and a half.
Yeah.
Do you have a kind of message for the Labour leadership here? I mean, we went to the mass lobby day around the benefit changes, and you know, we heard from disabled people that were going to be affected by the law change, who were sort of devastated.
I can't believe I'm still saying this, but simply bring us into that conversation, because I know with last year's benefit cuts, none of the disabled MPs voted for that. So yet again, it was non-disabled people making decisions for us. And I think we get it with every minority out there, but I think the fundamental problems in the world is when the decisions are made for us without talking to the people who will be impacted by these changes.
So I wanted to ask you about a subject which I don't know if you know this about. So I have a special interest in bins. It's a thing that I've talked about on the show. But I've got another special interest, which is toilets. I just find it fascinating. Yeah. Again, it's like bins. They're very quotidian, public toilets specifically, quotidian part of life. But actually, the fact that they exist, the fact that they're meant to be free, tells you about a functioning democracy and about inclusion.
Yeah.
So obviously, hearing that, The Guardian has reported that the number of public toilets in England has fallen by 14%, creating what they're calling lavatory deserts. Certainly took my interest. This is a little side note of Coco Trivia. But did you know that the suffragettes took up the cause of toilets? Because at the time, the fact that there were no public toilets for women meant that women were confined to the home. They could only travel for as long as they could hold their pee, essentially. That stopped them from participating in life. So the suffragettes took this cause up. So I think, you know, this is a cause that progressives should take up. Anyway, just on this subject, have you heard about this story? And how important do you think it is for the country to be a fair and decent place?
Oh, so important. And I think even the simplicity of toilets and accessible toilets, you'll know this, but it brings me back to the social model, which is the idea that my disability doesn't make me incapable or disadvantaged. I literally can do everything apart from drive, and I prefer to be driven, darling. And I cannot wear high heels. And I am a lesbian. So, Doc Martens all the way. But what does make me disadvantaged, what does make me less than in society is people's opinions on the disabled community. And that goes right from what people think of us to buildings, making them accessible, making toilets. Because of my CP, I have a very weak bladder. When I need a wee, I fucking need to go. And more often than not, the non-disabled person using the accessible loop is usually niche.
I would like to get out ahead of that. That was one time, and I apologise to you.
That's a very hot Nando's. So, yeah. What you just said about the suffragettes, it wasn't that women were incapable of leaving the house. It's just creating a world in which everybody can fairly access society.
We've sometimes talked about the kind of limitations of representation politics. You know, the idea that just by having more women and people of colour visible in positions of power, that doesn't necessarily guarantee better outcomes for those communities. But this is like a pretty amazing example of what happens when your political class is unrepresentative of the wider public, right? This is the very fact that the country's infrastructure
for its disabled citizens is collapsing can be linked pretty directly to the lack of political representation of disabled communities, right?
I get it on a personal level when I meet somebody and know if I've had very little interactions with a disabled person and initially they're awkward, they don't want to answer questions, and then you can see it clicks, they get it, and then they go, well, of course, Rosie should have access to everything that I am. And that's a thing I fundamentally don't think the current government are thinking of disabled people as people. They're thinking of us as statistics.
They're considering implementing the right to try policy, which will come into force at the end of April, if it is actually implemented. And it's going to allow disabled people to work without fear of losing their benefits. What else could the government be doing to support disabled people? Because it feels like the interest in that policy feels like it comes from getting the benefits bill down. Yeah. Or getting the unemployment statistics down. What could the government be doing to support disabled people living a dignified life? That, for example, a foundation like yours is kind of exists to essentially fill in that gap between what the government could be doing and what it is doing.
That's it. I really feel like they are driven solely to employment, and I get it, we need to get unemployment down, but that's not the best way to ensure longevity and to care for those people. I would say they need to focus on mental health. They need to focus on making those disabled people physically and mentally prepared for the world. And then we're able to tackle work. Because every disabled person I know wants to work, but we cannot be like, great, yeah, you do that, yeah, that'll work, when we're not caring for that individual person.
Before we go, what's next for Rosie Jones? What should our listeners be looking out for? And also, what can they do to support the work the foundation is doing?
So if you want to see me, turn on your TV.
Always humble, Rosie Jones.
And yeah, please give what you can. £60 will fund a counselling session for a person with cerebral palsy to see a trained counsellor also with cerebral palsy. And if you want to donate or learn more, rosiejonesfoundation.com.
Well, Rosie, well, I've always felt you are somebody that backs up the things that they say with the actions that they actually do. And you are a very force for good in our society and particularly within the comedy industry. I also think you're a piece of shit.
Mitch, I love you so much. And although nobody at home listening would think that, but for not only being a brilliant comedian, but you taught me how to speak out and how to do a job, but as well as that, keep that social conscience in the front of people's minds. So, Nish, you're my hero, and we cannot talk about this ever again, you piece of shit.
We'll cut this. If anyone sees this, I'll say it was AI. I'll say it was an AI, Rosie Jones.
Rosie Jones, thank you so much for joining us on Pod Save the UK.
Thank you so much.
And that's it. Thank you so much for listening to Pod Save the UK. If you like what you heard, leave us a review. It really helps boost the show.
You can follow at Pod Save the UK on Instagram, TikTok, Blue Sky and X.
Pod Save the UK is a reduced listing production for Crooked Media.
Thanks to lead producer May Robson and digital producer Jacob Liebenberg.
Our theme music is by Vasilis Fotopoulos.
Our engineer is Jeet Vasani and our social media producer is Leo Schick.
The executive producers are Kate Fitzsimons and Katie Long, with additional support from Ari Schwartz.
And remember to hit subscribe for new shows on Thursdays on Amazon, Spotify, or Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.